Session number 838.
Tony McLean, Reel 1.
Yes.
If we could just put it in context a bit, if you could tell me a bit about your family background.
Yes.
What your father did and so on.
Okay, well, my family background is my father was a clergyman. I went to Cambridge in 1929 to 1932, where I read history, and in my last year at Cambridge I joined the Communist Party.
Why did you do that?
Well, all the reasons you can think of, you know. I read Marx, it was the period of the world economic crisis, you know. I met a couple of ex-miners at Cambridge who became very close friends of mine, one of whom was an ardent member of the Communist Party, and I was extremely impressed, and I joined it. And I became, after I left Cambridge, I couldn't get a job, you know. I did all sorts of, you know, silly, dead-end jobs, which led me nowhere. And after 4 years, which is 1936, I got some lecturing for University College Nottingham, but external lecturing, you know, evening classes. But I was at that time, or had been, a very active communist, especially in 1935-36, and I had done a lot of speaking in public and this kind of thing, you know, various activities. So I knew exactly all the strings, you know, if I wanted to go to Spain. And I got very impatient during the winter because I wanted to finish my classes before I went to Spain, and I thought to myself, you know, time is passing. And then, of course, with the non-intervention committee, it became illegal. Whereas before, all you need to do is hop on a train, you know, and just turn up.
What did your parents think of your being a communist?
That led to some difficulties. Not a total rupture. It was a great grief to them, you know, particularly as I'd originally been an ordinand, you know, and had chucked this in, you know. This was a great grief. My father was a widower by this time, but you know, our relations actually were very good. You know, there had been some bad passages, but by and large, my relations with my parents were very good, you know, and they took it with great sorrow, you know, shall I say, with much more sorrow than anger.
Did you have brothers and sisters who did what they wanted them to?
Well, my two brothers, who were both still alive, have always been of the right, insofar as they're, you know, insofar as they have political views. They've always been traditionalist. And my sister was 11 years younger than I was, so she was only a child at this time, so this doesn't really, you know, this doesn't really come into the picture. However, I did, since I think we ought to have total candor, I did very remissly tell my father I was going to Spain to do relief work. I didn't tell him I was going to join up. I told him I was going out for Spanish medical aid, you know, and that I'd keep in touch and let him know what I was doing when I got there. Whereas, in fact, of course, I knew perfectly well that I was joining the international brigades. Well, I went to see the Communist Party organizer in Nottingham, you know, and I said to him, is it still possible to go? Because this was after the frontiers had been closed by the non-intervention committee, you know. And he said, yes, it is possible. He said, I'll let you know. So I waited for about 3 weeks. I had, 4 weeks. This must have been about the end of March, I think, beginning of April. And then the last week in April, he said, okay, you know, everything's ready, you go up to London on May the 1st. Well, I went up to London, and I went to King Street, which has become this party headquarters, which I'm sure you know, and I saw a mysterious man called Robson. Don't know, has he turned up in your tapes yet? Well, he was known as the mystery man because he, in fact, handled volunteers for Spain. You know about him already, do you?
I'd like to know what you remember of him.
Well, actually, it's the only time I ever met him. And he said to me, well, of course, you're a student. You know Paris well, don't you? And I said, well, actually, I've never been to Paris. He said, but you speak French. And I said, well, I speak school French. You know? So he said, well, look, I want you to act as guide to a group of, I think it was 13 people, mostly from Glasgow, who are going to Spain, and of course they don't know their way about France, and they've only got weekend tickets. I had a passport. I had one contact whom I slightly knew, a nice Londoner called Fred Thomas. I'd met him slightly before he was going out to Spain too. And I was only to talk to Fred Thomas. The people I was guiding were never to speak to me, and I was never to speak to them. You know, in other words, we were to maintain reasonable cover, you know. And it was on the evening of May the 1st, 1937, you know, off we started.
This is jumping ahead a bit.
Yes.
Oh, it sounds awfully easy. You're joining up in London.
Yes.
Did they try to dissuade you or talk to you about it at all?
No, they didn't try to dissuade me, but then I was reasonably well known in communist circles, you know. I mean, I'm reasonably well known. I didn't come out of the blue. Whether all the vetting was very good is a matter of opinion. All right. I think some of the vetting was very bad. But in my case, they didn't vet. Well, I mean, or if they had, I didn't know about it. And if they'd vetted, I didn't know about it, you know. And they wanted bodies, you know, because casualties were heavy, you know, and keeping the international brigades, you know, going with people was quite a business for them.
Had you been reading about the casualties?
Well, I knew. I mean, I read the papers naturally. You know, I didn't know realistically quite how bad it was. You know, at places like Harama, but I had some idea. You know, of course, friends of mine had already been killed. You know, this sort of thing. I had some idea.
How difficult was it at the time for you to have a good idea of what was happening in Spain?
Well, it's a difficult one that to answer fairly. I mean. Incredible. I knew people who'd been to Spain and come back, you know, because in the early years of the war, people very often went out just for a fortnight or 3 weeks, you know, and took a pot shot at a few fascists, you know, and then came home and addressed meetings. I'm not saying they shouldn't have done that, though there was a great deal of jealousy later, you know, when they tightened up. But I'm not saying they shouldn't have done that. And indeed, you know, from a propaganda point of view, it was very effective. You know, people had been out to the Spanish front for months or something like that, you know, and came back hot with news. So there was plenty of information. I don't think that one ever really sees a war realistically until one's in it. You know. But you get some idea. I mean, you know quite a lot. A lot of things you don't know. But, well, shall I say, I was reasonably well-read about Spain, insofar as it could be, you know, given things like war censorship, you know, things people weren't willing to say, things people couldn't say. So, reasonably, I suppose that way.
What were you told to take with you, how to prepare for going?
As little luggage as possible, which I didn't interpret very realistically. I took too much luggage, you know, and looking back on it, I think I took a fantastic amount of luggage. I only took one handbag. But if I may say so, it was crammed with things.
Well, you were theoretically on a weekend holiday.
No, I was theoretically on a holiday in Paris because I had a passport, you see. I didn't have to go through the weekend ticket. You know, I didn't have to go through the weekend ticket syndrome. It didn't apply to me. I had a passport, very foolishly. I had in my bag Basis and Essentials of Spanish and Teach Yourself Spanish, which in retrospect seemed ludicrous. You know, it's the last thing in the world I should have ever taken. I'll tell you a funny story about those later. Anyway... I went as instructed, you know, to Victoria, and we were to travel to Dunkirk and then to Paris. And I was given very, very careful instructions in King Street, you know, as to what I was to do when I was to get to Paris. We were to do the real hair stuff, you know, travel on the metro in the wrong direction, you know, change lines, you know, get off trains we just got on. And eventually, you see, after winding our way through the maze of the Paris metro, we were to end up at Aubervilliers, which is a working-class suburb to the north of Paris. And then we were to get out of the station, cross the road. There would be a big cafe opposite. We'd walk into the cafe and we'd ask for Rita. And Rita would tell us what to do. Well, I'll tell you who Rita was now. Rita was Mrs. Charlotte Haldane. Though I didn't know this. I mean, I found this out. You know, I found this out considerably later, a year or two later. Anyway, off I went. Fred Thomas was with me in the carriage because I liked to talk to him. You know, all the other people were on the train, but of course we weren't. We took no notice of them. And when I got to, this is real comedy, when I got to Dover, the immigration officer knew me personally, you know, and he said to me, "Hello, Tony, you said you're going to Spain." So I lied as effectively as I could, and I'm not a terribly good liar. Assured him I was going for a holiday in Paris, you know, and I wasn't going to Spain. He didn't believe a word of it, you know. And he said, the French police will send you back when you get to Dunkirk. He said, we better have a meal together tomorrow. And then he said to me later on, he said, "Don't worry," he said, "a lot of the French police are sympathetic. You won't have any trouble." Well, which of those to believe, I didn't know. However, I spent a somewhat anxious night on board ship, you know. I threw my Spanish primers into the English Channel, you know, with some regret. We'd swallowed them up. I tried to give Fred Thomas as careful instructions as possible how to get these chaps to Aubervilliers, just supposing I was detained by the French police. But this was all nonsense. I wasn't, you know, the French police didn't. I mean, the French immigration authorities didn't make any fuss at all, you know, and I went straight through. I don't think even they'd been told, you know. If they had, I've got no way of telling. Anyway, I went straight through to Paris.
Had you previously met the men who were going with you?
No, no.
So you didn't know who they were?
No.
How did you know who to take with you when you were going to and fro on the metro and all?
Now, difficult one to answer that. Had I actually seen them? I'd seen some of them. I think I had actually seen them and not spoken to them. You know, I think that I actually knew what they looked like, but had never spoken to them. I think that's right. And Fred Thomas was the sort of liaison man, you know, because he was allowed to speak to one or two of them, whereas I wasn't allowed to speak to any of them. They weren't allowed to speak to me. But I think I must have. I think I actually knew what they looked like, you know.
And they presumably knew what you looked like and knew that they were to follow you.
Yes, they knew what I looked like and they knew they would follow me. They knew they were to do exactly what I did, you know, including getting into carriages on the metro and then getting out again 3 minutes later, you know, just before it left the station and so on. Oh, this was all, you know.
That sort of cloak and dagger kind of thing is all very exciting and romantic.
Yes.
To what extent do you think that was significant in recruitment? I don't mean in your recruitment, but some people who would like the adventure. Yes,
there might be. Might be. There's one other person I met, an interesting person, whom I've almost forgotten, called Philippe Parfait, whom I met at King Street, a Canadian journalist. And he was also put in charge of a party. He was travelling to Paris too, but, you know, each of us in charge of a separate party. Now, I didn't see him on board ship. Perhaps they went, you know, perhaps they went slightly different route. You know, perhaps they went Boulogne or Calais instead of Dunkirk. Could have been. Anyway, I met him again in Paris. I don't know how far the cloak and dagger appealed, and frankly, I think it would have been the easiest thing in the world to have cracked if the French had been so disposed. You know, I mean, if the French wanted to pick us up. In fact, they did pick up quite a number of people going on the way to Spain. They usually waited till they got to the Pyrenees, you know, and picked them up there. But they used to let them out after about a fortnight, and then they used to cross the Pyrenees, you know. But the French didn't make things very difficult for us. You know, I mean, they were both observing non-intervention and not observing non-intervention. It was half and half, you know. They didn't make things very difficult for us. But they could have picked us up in quantity if they'd really wanted to, you know, because we were sitting ducks, really. Terribly easy to have broken our, you know, to have broken our transparent disguises, you know. Anyway, we got to Epiphilia in good order, in spite of this original excitement. We met Rita, who was Mrs. Charlotte Haldane, who was, I must say, a very, very strong personality, you know, very, very committed to Spain, spoke fluent French, which greatly helped, you know, and she gave us very firm instructions, you know, first of all, that we were on her account to drink, because we'd start talking, and secondly, if we were on her account to go with the girls, because they were probably all fascist spies, you know. And thirdly, that we must leave all our luggage behind, which would be sent to Spain under, you know, in a convoy, and only take, oh, I forget what she said, you know, a toothbrush and a hair, you know, a toothbrush and a comb, you know, things, in other words, that we could carry across the Pyrenees in our pockets. And actually, that was jolly good advice, though we never saw our luggage again. You know, that was a write-off, that hardly matters. And we would finally find ourselves at Figueras in Spain. I mean, this was the instruction she gave us. Well, I stayed in Paris for 2 days until the 3rd of May, and then I was sent off by train with a group to Lyon, Lyon, if you like.
Is this your same group of Glaswegians?
No, it's very strange. I can't remember where, but I think it must have been either at Paris or at Lyon. I was put in charge of a group of Canadians and Americans, and I never saw my Glaswegians again, the reason being that they hadn't got passports, as I had. And, of course, all the Canadians and Americans had passports, so I was put in charge of a group of Canadians and Americans. But where I last saw the Glaswegians, I'm not quite sure. You know, probably in Paris. They must have been shunted into Spain very, very quickly, because they were in France illegally from Monday onwards. So they must have got there through very quickly. Now, in our particular case, we got to Lyon early in the morning, and we were put on a coach, and we were taken out to a little place not terribly far from the Swiss frontier, going the wrong direction, in other words, you see, again, a place called Oyonnax. And when we got out of the train at Onax, we were given instructions, you know, as to how we'd recognise our contact. I can't remember what they were. Anyway, we were taken to the Maison de Peuple, which was the trade union headquarters, and welcomed by the mayor, a person called Mignon. Very, very amiable and friendly man, who then proceeded to allocate us all to hotels in Oyonnax. Now, it's very curious, the Oyonnax episode, because what we didn't know, of course, was that in Barcelona, the Republic had temporarily lost control, owing to the trouble with the fire and the boom. You know, these were the Barcelona days. And, of course, they didn't want us crossing the Pyrenees until Catalonia was again under control. We didn't know this. Though, it's true, I read the papers, but if I may say so, L'Humanité was remarkably uninformative about this. You know, actually, L'Humanité is the last paper I should have taken, because it told you less about what was happening in Catalonia, perhaps than any other organ of the French press. You know, it played it all down and pretended that nothing was really happening. Quite wrongly, you know, quite inaccurately. But never mind about that. You'll guess that I've abandoned my affiliations in the years that passed since then. At least you'll gather that from my narrative. Anyway, there we went to a hotel where I had a group of Finnish Canadians who could practically not understand the word I said, but were very nice. Pucker Canadians. I think they're all Canadians, actually. I did have Americans at one time, but I think these were all Canadians. And there we were in this hotel, and we stayed there for about 10 days. You know.
Were you busy pretending that you were not on the way to Spain?
Yes, we were busy pretending to be tourists. Mignon said to us, on no account drink the local wine. He said, it's very, very potent, you know, and you'll start talking. This proved to be very difficult, because every time I went to a restaurant or a cafe, you know, French people offered me a drink. They were terribly matey, you know. Also, if I may say, they're very curious. They couldn't think who we all were. Again, I think the French authorities must have been deliberately blind, because obviously, you know, there were rows and rows of people in Oyonnax. You know, what on earth were they there for? Of course, the hoteliers didn't mind. It filled their hotels, which was very nice, you know, gave them a nice clientele. And of course, none of the people I was in charge of could speak French. That's the reason I was in charge, because I could speak French. After I'd been, I used to go for long, long walks, you know, in the mountains, a very nice part of France, but most of the group, I must say, did remarkably little, and I used to sit in the evenings and translate L'Humanité for them, which I don't think was a very sensible exercise, but they liked it, you know, keep them in touch with the news. But after I'd been there for about a week, there was an article in the local paper, which was headed "Touriste" in quotes, you know, asking who these extraordinary tourists were of uncertain nationality who kept arriving in Oyonnax. Oyonnax, rather. I saw this article. My group weren't by any means the only group in Oyonnax. Lots of other groups were arriving, including a group led by Bill Alexander, whom you know. That's where I first met him, by the way. That's when I first got to know him, was in Oyonnax. Very few of us were English, because we were only English if we had passports. Most of the people were Canadians, Americans, most. They didn't observe very faithfully, if I may say, so the prohibition of not drinking that they were supposed to. When I'd been in the hotel for about a week, a little group came to see me one evening with the local schoolmistress, the institutrice, you know, and said to me, do tell us what you're all doing here in Oyonnax, you know. This was all very amiable, you know, very amiable of you. So I told them, you know, what lies I thought were most appropriate, you know. I said to them, well, I'm a schoolmaster, and I came to Paris. I was a bit short of money, and I met all these Canadians, you know, and they didn't know any French, so I offered to act as their courier, you see. They didn't believe a word of this, but, you know, it was the best story I could think of. And then the institutrice said to me, yes, he said, but it's term time, and you said you were a professor, you know. Why aren't you teaching, you see? I said to her, well, actually, in my branch of education, adult education, we don't have classes in the summer, which actually was broadly true, but I'm sure she didn't believe that. Anyway, it wasn't relevant. Anyway, nothing came of this interview. I told Monsieur Mignon, you know, Comrade Mignon, the communist mayor, and I told him that they'd been to see me. I'm sure he realized that the locals thought we were very, very odd. You know, we were very odd birds. Anyway, after
he
we'd been,
knew what you were there for.
Oh, he knew. Oh, yes, he knew. Oh, yeah, he knew perfectly well. After we'd been there for, I should think, 8 days, something like that. We were given instructions to go back to Lyon and travel to Montpellier, which we did by train. And I remember this very clearly. When we got to Montpellier, the French guide was going to shake hands with three people in turn, and each of us was to follow one of the three people he shook hands with. Again, you know, it's cloak and dagger, you know. Well, off we got at Montpellier. And again, my group had changed, by the way. My group was now American. Curious how they kept reshuffling the cards. My group were now American, very nice. And the French guide, shook hands with a French boy who took us into a working-class suburb of Montpellier. And there, in a basement, we stayed for 4 days. It's rather different from wandering around the mountains of Oinax, but never mind. Marvellous food. It was a half-Spanish family called Garcia, you know, who looked after us. And they gave us absolutely splendid food. But, of course, there was absolutely nothing to do. And I used to translate for them rather pulpy pamphlets by the French Communist Party about almost everything you could think of, you know. They had great stacks of those because they were Communist Party militants. The elder son was actually fighting in Spain because the family was called Garcia. You know, it was a Spanish immigrant family. The younger son, whom we dealt with, was too young. He wasn't allowed to go because I think he was only about 15. You know, he wanted to go, but he was just too small. Anyway, we stayed with the Garcias.
How worried were you and your party about whether you'd get to Spain?
Well, I wasn't at all worried. In fact, let me confess to you, I wasn't in the least in a hurry, but the other members of the party were. The other members of the party were fretting, you know. Why did it take about 3 weeks to cross France, you know? Why did it take so long? I wasn't in any very great hurry, you know. I thought we were sure to get to Spain, you know. You know, we'd get there in the end. But they were a bit worried, you know. And there were little tensions in the group, not very serious ones. There were little tensions in the group, but not too bad.
From whom did you receive your instructions so that you would know to leave the Canadians and take on the Americans?
Yes. Well, I used to meet from time... Yes, it's difficult to answer that in detail, but I used to meet from time to time, you know, French Communist Party emissaries, you know, who gave me instructions, and incidentally lots of money. They were extremely generous with money. I was as mean as hell, by the way, because I have a very Calvinist background, you know. The money given by the revolutionary workers, you know, shouldn't be just frittered away. I hung on to it all and gave it to the Spanish Red Cross after I got into Spain. But I realise now, I mean, in retrospect, I think this is foolish, you know. They wanted us to have a good time in France. You know, it's probably the last time we were going to have a good time, you know. And they weren't too worried about, you know, the occasional... I forget what they were now. It was pre-inflation, you know. And they seemed to me to be large numbers of francs. They wouldn't seem very much today, but it was. There was quite generous provision of money for us, you know. They used to give me quite a lot of money, so people could buy cigarettes and this sort of thing.
Not had you been expected to provide as much of your own as you could to pay your expenses?
No, not really. I did take some English money, some money with me, but not very much. Can't remember how much, I'm afraid. You know, it was very little. And actually, I had far more, I was provided with far more French money than I needed, you know, by the French Communist Party. Far more. You know, there was no shortage of money at all. The only thing we spent money on was sending cards home, which we did in great quantity, you know. I remember buying cards to all these places, you know, keeping my father, you know, more or less informed as to where I was, though hardly what I was doing, but at least where I was doing it. Anyway, we went from Montpellier to... I won't prolong this too much because it gets some... You know, it'll get 8 years. But then we went on to a place called Agde, and then eventually from Agde we went on to Perpignan. Of course, by that time we were close to the Spanish frontier. And in Perpignan, our instructions were to get out of the railway station and cross the square, the Place, and to go into a restaurant, which again had been very, very carefully described to us, you know, so we wouldn't make a mistake. Well, by this time, I had a group of, I should think, about 11 Canadians, Americans, same people I'd been with in Agde and Montpellier, that's right. And we sat down in this cafe, and of course we all had a meal, and we all had a very nice dinner, you know, they did us proud, and we waited for our contact. Well, we arrived in the cafe, I should think, about 5 o'clock, And 11 o'clock at night came, no contact. You know, and I thought, oh my God, now what do I do next? You know, where do we go from here? No contact. So I thought, well, the only thing to do is to book us all in at the hotel. Thank goodness I had plenty of francs, you know. So I sat down beside the girl there, a very nice girl, and we very laboriously got all the passports out, you know, and we copied all the details, you know, into their French register, you know, or who we all were. And I just finished this, which took about half an hour, when the contact turned up. It's about 11 o'clock at night, you know. And so, having booked rooms in the hotel, we all left the restaurant, you know, without ever having been to them. But I'm quite sure that the proprietaire, you know, knew perfectly well, you know, what he was doing. It was probably a communist restaurant anyway. You know, I'm sure the proprietaire knew that we were on our way to Spain. You know, you don't ask the wrong questions. Anyway, we all followed our guide, who took us into the woods outside Perpignan, to an enormous great shed, you know, or barn, which must have included, I should think, 200 or 300 volunteers, you know, of every nationality you can think of, you know, extraordinary miscellany of people that were there, you know. And then we stayed in the woods all next day, and that night we went across the Pyrenees. Now, actually, my documentation will tell you the exact date, which I think was the 27th of May. It's quite a long time since I'd left England, which was May the 1st. You know, it was quite a journey. Well, of course, then we had to walk across the Pyrenees. This had to be done at night. We were all issued with rope-sewed sandals, you know, so as not to make a noise. And, of course, there were non-intervention patrols. Not, I think, very many. But there were such things as non-intervention patrols. And, of course, other groups did blunder into them. Not ours, but other groups did.
Did you ever have any trouble with the French authorities at all?
None at all. Not the very slightest. In fact, I never had any contact with the French authorities. Never met any French authorities. No, there was no trouble with French authorities, whatever. You know, I never met one the whole time I was in France. But other people were less lucky. You know, other people did spend short times in French prison, but not us. Well, we then walked across the Pyrenees, which I suppose took about, 14 hours, something like that, you know. And we arrived, in my case, extremely footsore, if I may say so, you know, in Spain in the early morning of, I think it was the 28th of May, you know. And there we were, and we got to a little shepherd's hut, you know, on the Spanish side of the border. Absolutely marvellous view you've got of Catalonia, you know, as the sun came up, you know, most enchanting view. But we were very tired. And we stayed in this little shepherd's hut for, I suppose, an hour or two, and then an officer arrived from the Spanish Republican Army to take charge of us.
You didn't know any Spanish, at least.
I didn't know any Spanish. The only thing I said to the officer was caliente, which is the Spanish for hot. It's not what you actually say, but at least it gave me something to say. It's the only Spanish word I knew. Well, I dare say I knew how to say good morning, but that's about the only thing I could say. It was caliente. I remember saying that. Anyway, some of us walked down the hill, but some of us went by truck. I actually walked down the hill, which was a bit of unnecessary heroics. You know, these are the days of heroics. You know, I thought, well, I'm not going to get in the truck, I'll go down the hill. Which, considering I had blisters on my insteps, was not perhaps terribly sensible. Anyway, we got down the hill, and we got into trucks, and they took us to Figueras, which was had been used as a depot for the international brigades for, ever since the previous autumn, ever since the international brigades came into existence, Figueras. And I really...